I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. What happens to us after we die? We can see answers every day in movies and television, art and literature. Is there a heaven with bright light and pearly gates? And or a fiery inferno filled with tortured souls and lakes of fire? Is there descent into silence and peace? Or might we be reborn as someone else? The world's religions all try to answer this question. Sometimes the same faith answers it in multiple ways. Today, our religion roundtable returns to consider the afterlife. Why do people care so much about the great hereafter? And how do these beliefs shape our actions in the here and now? It's Up to Date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. Not a day goes by that the news doesn't raise one of the great religious questions of the ages. Whether the story is tragic deaths in natural disasters or civilian casualties in armed conflicts around the world, people of all faiths or no faith at all wonder what happens after we die. Even the recent predictions of judgment and doom at a particular moment on a Saturday evening in May tended to focus many people's thinking about their future plans, that is, their very long-term future plans. We have plenty of ideas expressed in art and entertainment and literature, but which of these images are actually rooted in religious claims? And how different are the different religious views about these things anyway? Why do people care so much? Isn't there enough to worry about in the here and now? We'll talk about these questions today, and to do that, we've reconvened our religion roundtable, where from time to time local clergy address questions of belief and values. And in a bit, we'll invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation, too. First, let me welcome Rabbi Mark Levin, who leads Congregation Beth Torah in Overland Park. Welcome.
Good morning.
Lama Chuck Stanford, who is Executive and Spiritual Director of the Rime Buddhist Center in Kansas City. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And the Reverend Dr. David May, who is Professor of New Testament at Central Baptist Theological Seminary, also a Baptist minister. David, welcome.
Thank you.
Glad to have all of you here. And I want to start with just the most basic of questions. A member of your congregation or community dies. We know what's happening to their body, but what's happening to them? Rabbi Levin?
When someone asks the question, I'll generally say something along the lines of, well, we believe that there's such a thing as a soul. And the soul that entered the body at some point, and I'm not definite with people about what that moment is necessarily, has been with the body through its entire life. And now at some point, not necessarily exactly at the moment of death, but at some point returns to God who placed it in the person. And so the person is eternal. And this particularly comes into play, by the way, when they look at the body and say, oh, my loved one is going into the ground. And I very frequently will say to families, no, that's not the case. Your loved one has returned to God, and you can have faith that the soul is eternal. And the body that was the temple for that soul is being returned to the ground respectfully from which it came.
So when you say has returned to God, it seems like the next question then is, what does that mean? What is it for a soul to return to God?
We believe that all people have souls, all souls come from God, and in wherever God's realm is, it returns to that paradise, which in Hebrew is referred to as Gan Eden or the Garden of Eden. So in some a way that I can't necessarily describe to people, we have the faith that that, in fact, continues on, and there's all kinds of anecdotal evidence that would say that yes, that's the case. I very often, by the way, there are probably many Jews in the audience right now who are saying, no, Jews don't believe in afterlife. But there's not been a Jewish movement that didn't believe in afterlife. It's just that most people don't talk about it very much.
And we'll talk about it a little later how even within various traditions, there seems to be a very wide spectrum of views on this issue in particular. Professor May, this sounds like something that Christians might affirm, at least in large measure. How would a Christian answer that question? What's happening to this person after they have died?
Right, and part of the reason it sounds very familiar is drawing up on this great tradition
and Christianity of understanding to be absent from the body is to be present with God. This is one of these great affirmations that occurs in the Christian tradition that death is not the end. There is something beyond. One of the things that Christianity builds upon is it's not just the spirit, but it is also the body that participates in the life thereafter. This is what we refer to as resurrection. And in the Christian tradition, Jesus becomes a paradigm for what will happen to an individual in the afterlife, in the sense that once one is resurrected to this newness of life, it entails both the spirit and the body. Now, in the Christian tradition, there's also some understandings of heaven that kind of get intertwined with the understanding of resurrection. So there are two things kind of operating side by side in the Christian tradition.
All right. Now, Lama Chuck Stanford of Rime Buddhist Center, a different take from Eastern tradition?
Yes, very different. We believe that the body dies, but our subtle consciousness does not die, continues on. And it goes by different names, mind stream, consciousness stream, and that we believe, of course, in karma and rebirth. And this subtle consciousness is not a soul, as in the Abrahamic faiths. It's not even an individual self, which I'm sure would raise lots of questions. But it's this very, very subtle consciousness that we believe that the body dies, but this continues on. And that, in fact, once one dies, this very subtle consciousness enters what we call the bardo, which is an in-between state. And one remains in this in-between state for up to 49 days. It may be less than 49 days. And while in this state, one has several opportunities to actually attain enlightenment. And if one doesn't, then one takes rebirth again, comes back. And we believe that we haven't lived just a few lifetimes or even a billion lifetimes. We have lived literally countless numbers of lifetimes over and over and over again. And enlightenment actually ends the cycle of rebirth. The term nirvana translated means to extinguish as in putting out a flame. So it ends the cycle of rebirth.
49 days, exactly 49. What's the significance of that number?
Well, 7 times 7 is 49. I think in mythology it's considered an auspicious number. I'm not sure exactly where that came up with. But it's actually can also be less than 49.
It's maximum.
Right.
All right. Mark?
The beliefs that have been mentioned actually also appear in Judaism, and I've often said that any great religion will have what every other great religion has in some capacity, maybe not with the same emphases or details. So in Judaism, there is also resurrection of the dead. And so there are these two different concepts that now go together in most people's minds. And that is that immediately the soul ascends to be with God. There is retribution or divine chastisement for up to a year. But then ultimately there will be, at least among the Orthodox, this is the belief, not so much in the Reform movement, where I'm a rabbi, but ultimately at the end of time, there will be a resurrection of the dead and all the bodies and souls will be reunited and go to Jerusalem. So there's the world to come where at death one can enjoy the pleasures of that, but ultimately everyone will be, or the righteous at the very least, will be resurrected.
Right. So it seems to me some differences both within traditions and between traditions with regard to what happens immediately when one dies and what will eventually happen with those who have died. We've only talked about what sound like primarily the good things that happen after someone dies. Obviously, that's some traditions have another understanding, right, David?
That's correct. We're talking about what happens to the righteous, what happens to those who have lived that life which is good and in fellowship with God, with the holy. But on the other hand, what happens to the unrighteous? What happens to the evil? In the Christian tradition, this comes under the category of hell. and there becomes this doctrine of a place of retribution, place of punishment. Now, how that's appropriated in the Christian tradition will vary. There will be some who will understand it as being a place of permanent, eternal kind of punishment. There will be those who see it as only a finite time of purifying, and at the end of time, hell will be emptied. And then there are those who see it as a place of consuming, where hell is a place of annihilation. That is the end of being. Mm. So lots of variations on how people understand that concept.
There's been a lot in the news recently about this, even within the more evangelical side of the church or the emergent church. An author, Rob Bell, has written a book called Love Wins, in which, much to the dismay of many of his theological peers, he declares that he's not so sure everyone doesn't go to heaven, as it were.
That's right. And that book has generated a great deal of interest in evangelical circles because they very much hold on to this doctrine of hell. And they think Rob Bell's perspective smacks of universalism. And so just recently, a major denomination within the last 2 weeks has voted an affirmation that hell does exist. So we've got this resolution, so it has to be, I suppose.
Well, right. Hell as determined by convention.
Right. All right. Exactly.
Lama Chuck, I'm curious, in a tradition that doesn't necessarily affirm a heaven or a hell, but rather a consciousness that moves on, what does your tradition say about lives that were perhaps not worthy or not admirable? What happens there?
Well, one of our doctrines is of karma, and karma is almost part of our everyday language now. I think people understand it as cause and effect. And so we believe that based upon one's lifetime, their actions, whether good or bad, will affect one's rebirth. Actually, Buddhism does have a belief in a hell. We believe there are 6 realms of existence that one can be reborn in. I think the big difference in Buddhism as compared, again, to the Abrahamic faith is that hell, well, I guess Dr. May mentioned that in some cases it's not always eternal. But in Buddhism, it's definitely not eternal. All of these 6 realms of existence are finite, are temporary. And one grows old, dies, and is reborn again. So if you have karma to burn off, if you've been really a horrible person, you might be in hell for who knows, you know, maybe 100 years or something like that, 500 years. But then you move on, okay? So it's not eternal. I think that's the important
point. Nothing is permanent.
Right. That's the important point.
I think there's probably a lot of folks who would have something they'd like to contribute to this conversation. So if you're listening and you have a different view than those you're hearing from our guests, feel free to call us and tell us about it. You can call us at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. What do you think will happen to you after you die? And how about to your neighbor? You can also email us at uptodate@kcur.org or find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter @kcuruptodate and send us your comments there. Mark Levin, I'm curious about why you think people care about these issues so much. And by that I mean there's enough to worry about in the present life, right? Why do people ask these questions? Why have they always asked them?
We're all human. And from a psychological perspective, you learned that this is the deepest question that all human beings ask about our mortality, that what is the meaning of our lives? And if we're going to die, why would that occur? Am I annihilated or do I continue on? So in some sense, the religious explanation denies the existence of death. It says that, in fact, death is an illusion, that you go from one type of existence to a human existence with a physical body, and then you return to another kind of existence. So what appears to be disappearance, what appears to be perhaps even the denial of the meaning of life for some, is in fact simply the illusion of the body going the way of all flesh, so to speak. The fact of a psychological explanation for why it's so important does not deny the existence of death. or the, excuse me, the existence of an immortality. It just simply says that we are driven to ask these questions, and a very popular explanation is that in point of fact, the body dies, but the spirit does not.
Do people worry about these questions too much, in your view, David?
I don't know if they worry about it too much. I agree that I think it is a question that occupies a lot of time in people's mind, especially perhaps as they get older or they have events happen tragically in life. These questions seem to come up. But it's questions that we all want to know because it's what is beyond. We are only here in this life that we know in the flesh, but what is beyond? I had this friend of mine who died several years ago, and I had a dream about him and I traveling in a car. And I knew he was gone, but in my dream, I constantly wanted to ask the question, what is it like? But in the dream, I could never ask the question. There is always that question, what is the beyond? What is it? And I think it occupies all of us at different points in our lives, but all of us deal with it in some way.
Well, Chuck, how long have you been leading the Rime Buddhist Center here in Kansas City?
Since 93.
Okay, so a good long time. Society's developed over that time. Have people changed in how they are asking these questions? Are people thinking about death and dying differently and what comes after?
Well, not in my experience, but part of that is because Buddhism actually places a lot of emphasis upon thinking about one's death, contemplating one's death. There's even a spiritual practice in Tibetan Buddhism where you imagine yourself as dead and your body rotting. And so there's a lot of spiritual practice that it's a preparation for one's death. And I think by doing so, I think it enhances one's life. I think it makes one's life better. We have something called the three roots of death. The first root is that the certainty we all will die. I mean, I don't think anybody would deny that. The second root is the uncertainty of when that will happen. None of us know the moment we'll die. When we walk out of the studio here today, one of us could drop dead, okay? And the third root is what will be of benefit to us at that moment of death. And from the Buddhist perspective, what will be of benefit to us is the karma, the spiritual practice that we've done, and the karmic imprint we've left on the subtle consciousness. And so if we've cultivated a lot of Buddhist virtues such as patience, compassion, loving kindness, that will affect our rebirth. On the other hand, if we've been mean, nasty, greedy, you know, cheated people, that too will affect our rebirth.
We're talking today about the afterlife on Up to Date on KCUR. 816-235-2888 is the number to call to become part of our Religion Roundtable. And Richard in Overland Park has called. Richard, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I really appreciate it. I'm raising my family in the Catholic Church. My children go to Catholic school. I myself am agnostic, and I have to tell you, I have a very, you know, sneaking suspicion that you live your life, you die, you're buried, and that's the end of it. And I feel so torn because I certainly, you know, like the idea of, you know, leading a moral and upstanding life and going to heaven and passing on. And I think that's a very positive thing for people who are going through the pain of death. And I would never, you know, trivialize that. However, I find it a difficult pill to swallow just in terms of logic. The church, in my mind, holds a very nice place for community and for a moral outlet to, you know, be charitable and to be among, you know, like-minded, in many aspects, like-minded people. Again, I just have a logical problem with anything other than a beginning and an end to an individual. And I'll take my comment off the air. Thank you.
Appreciate your call very much, Richard. Thank you. Mark Levin.
Obviously not coming out of the Christian tradition, but out of the Jewish tradition, we refer to Judaism as a this-worldly religion, by which we mean that it's your actions in this life that are for this life, and that one is to live a righteous life, I think, as the caller referred to it. For us, that's living according to God's commandments, but certainly doing that which is moral, that which benefits humanity, that which Lama Chuck's explanation would leave a karmic imprint. So all of that is the reason that we're alive. And the afterlife will take care of itself. So we're not supposed to spend a whole lot of time ruminating about our actions in terms of whether they will get us into the afterlife. Rather, we live the righteous life here in order to create the best of all possible worlds here. And if we do that, then an eternal life is guaranteed. Now, obviously, the benefit of that from someone who doesn't believe is, A, if you live a righteous life, you achieve it regardless of what your belief happens to be. And B, you get to focus on how you live here, and the afterlife will just take care of itself.
So in contrast with the idea that heaven is an incentive to do well, or hell is an incentive to do well. This is the idea: is you just do it because it's the right thing to do in the here and now, right?
Heaven is a place that one would go because one did what one was supposed to do in this life.
But that's not why you do it.
But you don't do it. As a matter of fact, it's a detriment. A little bit of a detriment if you do it for that reason, right? You should live righteously in this life simply because that's what God asks you to do.
It's interesting. Wade in Lawrence has written us by email concerning the concept of being saved in the Christian tradition. Some believe you can be a horrible person your whole life and be saved in the 11th hour, while strapped into the electric chair, if you will, and others believe your works are important. Also, and conversely, some believe that you can be saved at 4 years old, live an evil life, but still make it to heaven. I'm curious, David May, your thoughts about this, the idea of the 11th hour save. Is that a problem for Christianity?
It is a problem for some in Christianity because the Christian tradition certainly emphasizes that what one does here matters, that one orients their life while they are here toward God. It's the compass toward which you are pointed and directs your life and focuses you. And at the end, to kind of, you know, burn your whole candle kind of in the service of evil, and at the very end to kind of make this decision, really does fly in the face of kind of what it means to live out one's life here to also experience what it is in the afterlife. Although I think always on these issues, when it comes to the afterlife and it comes to heaven, it comes to hell, we are always going to be speculative. We live on this side and not the other side. So I'm always very cautious and living with a bit of humility of making those kinds of pronouncements.
Maybe not a bad policy in general. Let's talk to Dan in Fairway. Dan, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me. It's good to be here. I'm an atheist, and I believe that the majority of religions, when they've been studied, when somebody is experiencing a strong religious experience, it's triggering the exact same area of the brain. And that doesn't seem to lend any credence to any one of them, since any of them, and they disagree with each other so strongly, all trigger the same part of our physiology. And that and many other reasons seems to draw much of it into question.
Okay. I appreciate that comment, Dan. What do we make of that more sort of scientific sort of explanation for this sort of belief? Mark?
I'm so pleased for this phone call. My belief is that God created us in a certain way, and of course God God has created us as physical beings. So to say that there is an area in the brain through which we would function in such a way that we believe that we have faith that there is an eternal existence, simply say that God has created us in such a way that we might be able to believe in such a thing. So that's not a contradiction, a logical contradiction to religion whatsoever, any more than to say that the fact that people universally seem to pray either proves or disproves the existence of God. Perhaps God created within us the impulse to pray so that we would, all of us, universally be able to recognize the fact that there's something greater than ourselves. But let me say that it doesn't make any difference to me whether a person is an atheist and believes in some sort of eternal life or some sort of eternal existence or not. One can still live a moral life and have the same outcome. regardless of whether you happen to believe that there is another existence or some divinity.
Well, and that seems to me one distinctive view among different traditions where in certain Christian traditions, it isn't – if you don't seek this outcome, if you don't have faith in this this understanding, you're not going to receive this outcome, right, David?
That's right. You have to be oriented toward it to receive it. It's not just something that comes to you by living a good or moral life. There is a conscious decision.
Let's take one more call from Mike in Baldwin City. Good morning, Mike.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm kind of unique. I'm son of clergy. I'm American Indian, and I'm an agnostic, part of studying the history of what Christianity did with tribes here in this country. But at the same time, a lot of the tribes have different beliefs because there were so many different tribes. I had a Kickapoo elder who since passed tell me about 20 years ago that if you're good in your living time, you're amongst all your people in the afterlife. But if you're bad, you wander the desert with nobody. That's just kind of a direct sense of responsibility to be good in the living time, from what I took from it.
Interesting point, Mike. Thanks so much for the call. Any reaction to that, Mark?
Yes, actually, we believe that punishment only takes a year. So that's probably different than other traditions. So anybody who dies is going to be punished for, I like to say, Moses one day, Mark Levin 364. But the maximum is the year, so that and the Talmud says that the righteous of all faiths have a place in the world to come. So we're all of us going to receive some sort of punishment because there is no person who doesn't sin. But according to our deeds will be the length of time that will go on. And ultimately, everyone gets to some sort of a reward.
We're going to continue this conversation after the break. We do want you to be part of it, though. Call us at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. What impact have religious teachings had on your experience of death and of thinking about the afterlife? Maybe you've lost a loved one or you've faced the possibility of death yourself. Call us at 235-2888 or email us at update@kcur.org. You can also find us on Facebook, the KCUR page, or follow us on Twitter at KCUR UpToDate. Stay with us through the news. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to UpToDate on KCUR. And welcome back to UpToDate. I'm Brian Ellison. If you're trying to get a bit more out of your garden this year and you missed last Friday's visit with the editor-in-chief of Organic Gardening, you can find that program and all of our older broadcasts at kcur.org/UpToDate. Tomorrow, the short, stout, necklace, and lovable cartoon character, that's right, Ziggy, turns 40 this year. The creator of Ziggy, Tom Wilson, will be joining us on the show to celebrate the anniversary. So tune in tomorrow to UpToDate. You can join today's conversation about the afterlife with our religion roundtable by calling 816-235-2888 or emailing us at update@kcur.org. Joining us are Dr. David May, who's a New Testament professor at Central Baptist Seminary, Lama Chuck Stanford, spiritual director at the Rime Buddhist Center, and Rabbi Mark Levin from Congregation Beth Torah in Overland Park. Lama Chuck, what do you say to those who find these ideas, these conversations about the afterlife, to be more about comfort for the dying, more about comfort maybe sometimes for the living, the survivors, than in fact about what is actually true or what is real?
Well, you know, I suppose none of us will know for sure until we die. I think, you know, it's to a great degree speculation. So I think there is of course a need to want to be comforted. Rabbi Levin mentioned earlier, I think it's kind of a fundamental question about being human, you know, what it means to be human. So, I think we won't know until ultimately until we die ourselves.
Yeah. Let's take a call from Robert in Archie. Robert, thanks for calling the program.
Hi, how are you today?
We're doing great.
I think I just, 97% water or carbon and 2% water or whatever. And when I die, I think I'll just be put back in the earth, you know, to be what we borrow from the earth while we're living. I don't understand this everlasting life thing or where the soul's supposed to reside in the body.
Robert, I hope this isn't a rude question. Would you mind telling us how old you are?
47.
And how far does it not matter to you? I mean, you've got a presumably a long life ahead of you. Is it because it's so far away that these things don't matter, or is it a more sort of objective scientific perspective you're taking?
No, it matters to me most of all because of the herbicides I've had to use it without protection because they said they were safe, like Roundup and such. I'll probably be lucky to see 55 at that. So it's not that I've got a long time. It's just I see my children and grandchildren as being my only immortality, and I don't see any logic. There's no measurement or weight in this religious thing, you know, because everybody's got a different point of view, even if they go to the same church. They've got to, because people are individual. You know,
Robert,
and it just seems to me a way more that you get out of religion is arrogance and greed and bloodthirstiness, and you know, one people's better than the other, or one religion's better than the other, and these are going to heaven and these are going to hell. And I think if people would just get along, do no harm, quit destroying our habitat, because the sea creatures, they're going extinct according to marine biologist and scientist by measurement and weight, not by superstition. It's actual happening, you know.
Robert, I really appreciate I appreciate that.
I think you made your point. Why don't we just take care of what we got, get along, and when God comes here, let him judge everyone instead of judging everyone for him and killing each other and destroying our habitat, spending all of our money on bombs and
got it.
Other stuff.
Robert, I've got a lot of calls today, so I appreciate your calling in. But I think Robert did make a good point, and in fact, he noted that he thinks for him the afterlife is children and grandchildren, which that's not a completely unreligious perspective, right, David?
Right. That's very true. Actually, the perspective he came out with first, that your water, your carbon, you simply disintegrate. That's it. This is, and as another caller indicated also, the same idea. This is an old idea. In the study, if you want to know what people believe about death, you go to the cemeteries, look at the tombstones. And if you went back in the ancient world and looked at the tombstones, his perspective would have been on many, many tombstones. And it was something like this that they would carve in Latin. I was not, I am not, I care not, which says basically that's all there is. But into that were these traditions that small groups, Judaism, Christianity, that said, no, there's something beyond that, that the essence of who we are. Now, are we going to prove it to a person's using a metric? No. This is where this concept of faith comes in that people struggle with, but helps people through these difficult times.
Let's talk to Debbie in Lee's Summit. Debbie, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. I am interested in what is the Buddhist take on someone who dies before their time. In November, I lost my 30-year-old son, and he was perfectly healthy, clear up until the day he died. An undetected brain tumor. What is it that would, in Buddhism, how do they feel, how do they explain things like that happening?
Debbie, thanks for sharing that. Let's ask Lama Chuck Stanford about that. Chuck?
Well, Debbie, let me first offer my condolences. I'm so sorry to hear about the loss of your son. As a parent and a grandparent, I can't even imagine losing a child, and so I'm very sorry. From the Buddhist perspective, really everything that happens to us in this phenomenal world is the result of our past karma. And so someone who dies at an early age is the result of some past karma. We, of course, don't know what that might be, But that would be the Buddhist explanation.
Okay.
So Chuck,
and
does that...
Would that be his own spirit's karma, or would that be the karma of his parents, or...
Oh no! It would be his karma from a past life or lives. Uh huh.
Uh-huh.
So it's not just the present life that is considered in
right.
No, right, right. Our karma can ripen in this lifetime or in future lifetimes. So we never know.
When it ripens, is that he's gone around as many times as he needs to, and now he's ready for nirvana?
No.
Okay.
In nirvana, enlightenment is really through purifying the obscurations of our mind and really through a lot of spiritual practice. Probably would not happen in one lifetime. For most of us, it would take many, many, many lifetimes to achieve.
Right. Well, I always felt like really, almost from birth, he was an old soul, very mature for his age and wise beyond his years, and extremely giving and helpful. And, when you talk about giving back to society, just amazing, especially for his age.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just wondering, if that had anything to do with it.
Well, probably not regarding his death, but the Dalai Lama is often heard to say, if you want to know what your past lives were like, mm-hmm. look at your current situation, because that's dictated by your karma of past lives. If you want to know what your future lives will be like, look at your current actions. So those positive actions that he had in this lifetime, the kindness, all of the virtues that he cultivated will definitely benefit him in future lifetimes, again, from the Buddhist perspective. And again, I offer my most sincere condolences. I can't imagine losing a child.
It's tough.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Debbie, thank you
so
much for your call. And I'm I'm interested. She specifically asked what Buddhism has to say about that situation, but I think the question could be asked of other traditions as well. Mark Levin, what about people who die before their time? Is there something different about that?
There are lots of traditions in Judaism that a person dies according to his sins. And also that we die according to our ancestors' sins. And there are such quotations, of course, in the Bible, Deuteronomy, Jeremiah, Ezekiel immediately come to mind. But having said that, we really don't know, do we? I have a 17th century sermon on my shelf, which a man questions why someone died young. And the answer that the rabbi offered in this sermon was that is a reincarnation of a soul that had a debt that had to be paid, and therefore that person died. Well, how anyone would know such a thing is beyond me. We don't really know, but there are all kinds of explanations like that.
It sounds very Buddhist.
Yeah. Well, like I say, every great thought is in every great religion. But it seems to me much more important is not why it occurred, but what kind of comfort can we find from the community in which we live. People who lose those who are so intimate, so loving, so much a part of our lives need the support of the people around them. We do often say that when God closes a window, he also opens a door. And so one also might look and see what opportunity might there be. But it seems to me most important in these moments of crisis is for us to rally to that person and say, you're going through a terrible trial in your life, and that's what life is often about. What might we do in being supportive that would enable you to get through this period that's so difficult?
David May, I'm a Christian minister myself, as regular listeners will know, and one of the way this question often comes up in my context is when folks ask about a child who has died, or maybe even a youth, but someone who has not yet really had an opportunity to become the person they would have become. How does Christian perspective take that?
Right. And some people answer with very cut-and-dried answers that seem very glib and answers I don't like, such as, well, it must be the will of God. This is perhaps one of the worst answers you could ever give to someone in a situation like that, because certainly the will of God is for every human being to reach their fullest potential that they can be and live. But in a sense, what the rabbi has said is very, very true. It's the sense of what we do now in the midst of a world that has contingencies, where winds come together and there are tornadoes and people die, where children get brain tumors. It's not God who is doing this, but it's the created world in which contingencies can happen. Jesus one time was asked the question, this blind man, why is he blind? Did he sin or did his parents? And Jesus said, basically, you're asking the wrong question. It's not sin, but what will we do now with this man who's here in our midst? And Jesus heals the man. So the idea of sin causing these things, I think, is a wrong answer to give when these bad things happen to good people.
You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking today with our Religion Roundtable about the afterlife. You're welcome to join the conversation. Do you live differently because of your hope or your fear about what stands on the other side of death for you? Call us at 816-235-2888 or email us at update@kcur.org. Mark Levin?
I want to put in another religious response, and that is, it seems to me that these moments of tragedy also demonstrate to us not only the power of loving, but the mystery of life. We can become so focused on our own pain that we forget that there is inherent in every cell this beauty that is ineffable. We lose track of that. And sometimes we just have to sit back and say, thank God that this life has occurred. And I don't mean to be preaching. It's a caution for all of us to be able to appreciate at each moment how precious life truly is.
Let's talk to Michael in Overland Park. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hello there. Hey, just my 2 cents worth, for what it's worth, 2 cents, is I don't really give a rat's ear about the concept of an afterlife. I live in this world and attempt to do what is empirically, determinably right, simply because this is the world in which I can prove that I exist. If there is an afterlife, I'll let it sort itself out. My closest thing to a hell would be to be remembered as a horrible person, and my closest thing to heaven is to be remembered as a good person. I don't really buy any particular doctrine. My only axiom in life is that anyone claiming to have the one answer probably doesn't.
Appreciate that perspective, Michael. It sounds like that many here of our listeners share that what really matters is what has happened or how you live your life, not what comes after it. I'm curious for our three guests today, as we approach the end of the hour, if we might talk for a moment about funerals or burial ceremonies in your various traditions and the ways that those ceremonies reflect the beliefs of your traditions. And Lama Chuck, I think we might start with you. I think probably most of our listeners are least familiar of all with Buddhist practices around the time of a death.
Are you talking about the actual funeral itself?
Yeah. How that funeral reflects beliefs about the afterlife?
Well, I think here in the West we've adopted more of a Western style funeral as Buddhist. At least I have. I perform funerals. There are certain prayers and practices that. That I do for someone who has passed on. But the funeral itself would look very much, I think, like a Christian or a Jewish funeral. I mean, I give a eulogy. Maybe the difference is I explain the Buddhist concept of death, as we talked about earlier. And it's encouraged for the loved ones to do their best to let go. Because grief, I believe grief is really kind of a clinging, a grasping, not really letting go of the person, the loved one who has passed on. And when in this bardo state that we talked about earlier, it's believed that clinging and grasping by family members might actually impede the progress of the departed through the bardo. So it's encouraged to let go. There's also a practice we do called tonglin, practice. It's a meditation practice where we try to alleviate the suffering of others. And it's also encouraged to do this practice during that 49-day period. And so we have kind of a beginning and an ending. And I think it's also in Judaism. I know you sit Shiva. I think that's there's great benefit to that because there's real closure with that. So at the end of the 49 days, we have another ceremony where we actually burn a photograph of the individual because we believe the person now has either reached enlightenment or has taken rebirth. So I think having a beginning and an end, I think, I believe is very helpful for family members.
Is the burning of the photograph something that's paralleled in other parts of the world by actually burning the body?
Actually, there's no – within the Buddhist teachings, it's not dictated how to dispose of the body. But I think in most parts of at least the Asian world, it's usually done by cremation. But it's not dictated.
I see.
Yeah.
Mark?
We have a number of customs that are traditional, I think, are done at most Jewish funerals. Most particularly, people relate to the idea of saying a prayer that it's actually in Aramaic, the language that Jesus spoke. That's called Kaddish. And what I find is that most often people really do want to connect with that part of tradition that links them with the past. People will very often say, just tell me what I'm supposed to do. I want to do the right thing. I want to do that which honors my beloved. I want to do that which is going to guarantee eternal life or is going to make me feel better. But just give me the right way to react. So Kaddish is a big piece of that. Of course, it's not a language that people naturally speak by just growing up in the United States. So sometimes it can be a little bit difficult for people. They have to be able to learn the words. The other thing is that I do give eulogies, as do my colleagues, about the person. And I very often hear from the people in the funeral home that Christian clergy don't do that as much. And in our tradition, it's a matter of sort of summing up the life rather than talking about the afterlife. So that may be a little bit different for people.
Well, and is that different, David, in Christian funeral practice?
Certainly in the Christian practice, there is an emphasis on the afterlife, that there's going to be scripture that will be read that will be highlighting hope in the next life, resurrection. But I think especially, and this is what brings comfort to the family, is the idea that heaven is a place of communion. That if you want to think about what hell is isolation. It's by yourself. One of our listeners called in and said, it's like being in a desert by yourself. Well, that's hell. There is no communion. And so in the Christian funeral, the idea that this person who has passed is with mother and father, is with grandparents, and that I someday will see my mother. I will see those who have meant the most to me, know them, they know me. That is a sense of a hope that is very sustaining in the Christian tradition and highly emphasized in the funeral services.
Let's take one more call from Patrick in Overland Park. Patrick, welcome to Up to Date.
Welcome. Thank you.
Tell us your question or comment.
Yes, I had a near-death experience January 2006. I was on an airplane at 30,000 feet, had a sudden cardiac arrest, and died on the airplane. Was dead for about 5 minutes before I was resuscitated with an AED. My heart had stopped. My brain had stopped. I had transcended into the other world. I can tell you this, that I have subsequently met maybe 100-150 people who have had sudden cardiac arrest throughout the United States as a result of being part of a national sudden cardiac arrest organization. I've interviewed many of them, and I've written the book, Second Chance, Surviving Sudden Cardiac Death, which is primary.
In 30 seconds or so, Patrick, what happened? I mean, did it validate religious expectations of that time for you?
I have to no. In fact, it changed them. I asked many questions while I was on the other side. I begged to stay. I didn't want to come back. I literally didn't want to come back, and I was sent back, as the experience of many of us. But the experience was is that there is a God. There's a very powerful God, and it's more like a collection of souls. It's not a he. It's not a she. It's more like a collection of souls. And I ask about religion in particular, and the impression I got was is that religion is important while we're here on Earth. because it helps guide us and provides a patchwork of things that we need to know and to guide our lives. But it's essentially man-made, and we leave it behind. We don't take it with us.
And Patrick, how different is that from what you would have believed before you had this experience?
Basically, the Judeo-Christian tradition, mm-hmm. that your religion, and that there was a heaven and a hell. I had no impression of hell or anything like that. I got the impression everybody went to the same place. No sense of judgment. But I had a lot of questions and a lot of answers. And I would like to hear what the your panel has to say.
Well, unfortunately, Patrick, you won't get that opportunity because we are out of time. So you got the last word, and I encourage you to contact them and ask them yourself. You can find Rabbi Mark Levin at Congregation Beth Torah in Overland Park. Thanks for being here, Mark.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Lama Chuck Stanford is Executive and Spiritual Director of the Rime Buddhist Center in Kansas City. Thanks for being here, Chuck.
Thanks for inviting me.
And David May is Professor of New Testament at Central Baptist Seminary. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.